Do you really want me to stay up here?
Yeah. Thank you very much. I hope this microphone is working. Thank you very much, Professor Dirks, for this erudite lecture, talk, which gave us enormously wide sweep of 1.5 centuries, maybe, in bringing us into the present, of a very complex topic. I have a lot of questions that I would like to ask, but I think we felt that this lecture would not be complete without a discussion. And that's why we have made special arrangements to have microphones here so that the audience can pose the questions that are important, and Professor Dirks will remain at his pulpit. So that we have a lot of microphones to go around. I bid you to pose your questions. And if you prefer to state your question in German, there would be somebody who could translate it. And that would be very good if students would participate in this. Especially the students who have read Hearts of Mind and have attended my lecture on colonialism, maybe have seen certain resemblances in our approach. I would be very happy if students would just have the courage to pose fundamental questions, or not so fundamental, but please. Yes, we have our Schröder, who is going around with the microphone.
Thank you. Well, I also have a lot of questions, but I'd like to ask just two, which are rather certain, rather difficult. First of all, you presented us a nice sequence of key issues of public debate in England. We started with Tipu Sultan, then next was Sati, then Tapi, and then 1957. I'm just wondering, 1957, sorry, something different. I'm just wondering, does it really start, in your opinion, with Tipu Sultan, or is there any certain predecessor? And that again, it ends with 1857 in a way. I also see that there is a change in the public opinion. But what about other things in between, like Meria sacrifice? I do not know whether this had much impact on public opinion in Great Britain, but I estimate that it could have. I mean, I read some missionary reports that they were really or Major Campbell's report, and I can imagine that this also had some impact.
I'm sorry, can you repeat what you said?
Media sacrifice.
Okay, yeah.
And the second question is a little bit easier. It's about history. The ethnographic state was obviously there, but what about the historiographic state? I see that if one loses the idea of empire and a very universalist approach to India, the view of Indian history results in just one thing, no history at all. But I don't think that all the colonial administration really came up with that result. I think there was more. I mean, Colonel Mackenzie, as far as I know, has not written much on history, even though he collected it. I'm just wondering where are his writings. I read something about inscriptions, but that's all. So what did they really know about history, and why did they not use history more in their civilized agenda?
Yeah. Thank you for your questions. In the first case, I guess one of the reasons why I'm rehearsing some fairly well-traveled examples that everyone has heard of, whether you've studied India extensively or not, is the extent to which these in a variety of ways were useful precisely because they constituted the basis for scandal. And so in a way, this is a paper about the history of scandal as a way to address, to represent, to mobilize interest and support for a colonial project, right? So in that sense, the linkage between Burke and his impeachment hearing, where he adumbrated scandal after scandal after scandal, principally the scandals, of course, conducted by Warren Hastings, but also a variety of scandals that took place under his watch, and which were described with such horrific detail that that women were said to swoon in the hall, and Burke himself had to, at some point in the middle of his speech, stop talking and take snuff. And when he finished, in fact, he fell into the arms of Richard Sheridan, who was standing next to him, and had to be carried away. What was to make visible, in some sense, the very detailed reports that he had been co-authored, looking into company corruption, scandals of various kinds, and so on and so forth. In particular, in the 1770s, 1770s and 1780s. He was also, in addition to being concerned about Bengal, he was concerned about the South, and he gave one of his most fiery speeches about the debts of the Nawab of Arcot. I'll talk about that tomorrow. But the interesting point, as I was beginning to do some new work on Burke, was to see the same language and rhetoric of scandal continues, and it continues in particular with Grant and Wilberforce, and the way in which Sethi and Puggy become substitutes for, and very important substitutes for, the kind of scandal that the 18th century saw from the point of view of London. Human sacrifice, Maria sacrifice, was much written about. The Missionary Register had a lot of excerpts of descriptions. There were a couple of cases from the 1830s. I think there was a Colonel Crawford who went to basically attack various groups that were said to be causing problems, perhaps thugging problems, perhaps others. And human sacrifice was described in great detail as another way in which to justify colonial interest and attention. And of course, at this point, well, indeed, from the time of Hastings on, the problem in part was that the British administrators in India, who engaged in elaborate military exercises, constantly were being holed up in front of Parliament because they were doing what Bush is doing in Iraq. I mean, they were basically creating huge deficits. There was no money to support these activities, so they had to find some way to justify what they were doing. Now, in a way, in a sense, there's an imperial justification, but from the point of view of the budget, it's not sufficient. I mean, even that isn't sufficient. So there has to be this kind of, elaborate use of scandal, and so in that sense, you're quite right to point to Marriott sacrifices as something that was used. It didn't have the same level of interest as Thuggee and Sethi, but human sacrifice was talked about as being fairly common in India, and it often got affiliated to Thuggee. As for the second question about the historiographical state, I actually suggested in Cast of Mind that to some extent, the late 18th and early 19th century was a time when the British interested in India wrote a great deal more history than they did ethnology. And indeed, there were in the histories of India that were written by people like, say, well, Mill wrote a very particular history, but Elphinstone, the sections on ethnology were just sort of excerpts of Orientalist characterizations of, say, the Manushmiti, and sort of dharmic textbooks about caste and about dharma and the like, without there being that much in the way of social description. If you go back to Alexander Dow's a translation of Ferishtal from 1770-72, again, there's 7 pages on customs and caste and so on and so forth, and the rest is all, of course, about either the abuses of Clive — he's very much on the anti-Clive side — Or just the translation of the Mughal chronicle itself. So Mackenzie there plays a very interesting role. He doesn't write very much. He has writer's block. He also doesn't know any Indian languages. I mean, one of his problems is that he's not an Orientalist. He's an obsessional collector, He's a surveyor and a cartographer, of course, a very fine skill. But what he did was to produce this chaotic, miscellaneous, huge archive of historical materials that he was convinced would produce the basis for a connected history of the Deccan, at the very least, if not of all of India. And nobody, of course, ever connected the dots, because by the time he died in 1821, the collection was seen as being neither appropriate for proper Indological study, on the one hand, which is why H.H. Wilson took up the catalog, but then sort of dropped it as fast as he could to do something else to develop his credentials for the professorship at Oxford. At the same time, it was not sufficiently certifiable as history, because there were too many mythological, fanciful tales and the like that are part of the archive. So in some sense, the historiographical project falls between the cracks of official Indology or Orientalism and a kind of administrative interest that then soon becomes overtaken, and as I argue here anyway, overtaken by increasing interest in an ethnological view rather than an historical or historiographical one.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think it's very good you're standing up there, because this venue is really ideal for the topic. I mean, and having this sort of neoclassicist.
I hope I get some authority by virtue of standing up there.
Yes,
Grizzly is remembered for its sort of racialist theories, and I love your image of Grizzly with the uppers in one hand and nasal index in the other, or whatever it was. But I wanted to ask you about the language, because one forgets this wonderful catalogue of what you characterized as fairly contemporary ethnographic observations. You could say, with that list you have about who takes water from whom and who takes food from whom and so forth, he's got, along with his infamous racialism, and along with his sort of cadastral survey and census commissioner and all of that, then he has a kind of nascent theory of caste as emerging from a set of practices. It's a kind of nascent practice theory. And how does that sit then with the racialism? Does it simply reflect it? Is it an overlay which grows out of his racial? These things do not really fit together. They contradict each other. And so that was really my question. When I heard that list, I also thought of things like the Mulki Ayn and other lists of that is legal codes in the various little kingdoms in Himalaya, which also have those kinds of lists and also have particular legal sanctions associated with giving water or accepting food from the wrong person. So the question is, if you could just say something more, clarify this interesting contradiction between the practices, which I see as pretty much reflecting an indigenous view of things. Maybe he was really onto something here by being able to list these practices, along with the racialism and colonial agenda, on the other hand.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the points I'm trying to make is that you actually have to put those together in order to understand why it is that it's a problem. In a sense, his catalog of how you adjudicate, how you adumbrate, how you assess social precedence is indeed a fairly unproblematic charter for starting fieldwork in a village, And yet, because it is, in some sense, developed under the general rubric of his racial theory, which is there from his writings on Bengal in 1891, he has these extraordinary interpretations of a frieze from Sanchi, where he sees, the whole racial tableau of India reflected in, in different animals, and it's quite excessive. Which is the frontispiece of his book on Bengal. In order to in some sense see why it is a problem that a particular kind of ethnographic interest gets blown up. Of course, he derived these lists and these catalogs and these kinds of these sets of distinctions, both for collecting information about what people say they do, and also for collecting information about what people did. I mean, they were both part of his enterprise. From a group of local pundits who he took to the local authorities of that caste. And they included people like Rajendra Lal Mitra, who was one of his correspondents, and whose writings help document the case that he makes for the use of native social precedents in the 1901 census. But what it does is to take a particular view of caste hierarchy and the like, and a particular set of indices, as opposed to a whole variety of other things, which he could have added in there. And then, indeed, install them in some sense as the kind of native ideology of racial practice. And racialism gets, of course, inscribed through this notion that the caste is endogamy. That in effect, you have these seven racial groups that haven't intermarried, and that's why everything from blood to noses will reflect on empirical scrutiny the distinctions that he claims to be, part of a broader racial a differentiation of these seven groups across the subcontinent. So I'm just restating in some sense your question, only to respond by saying that it was precisely the fact that these were all part of the same package, and then that they had the authority of the census and the authority of the state, and that they were conjoined with a complete disinterest in engaging local social reform movements in Bengal. They were conjoined with his ethnographic authority that he got with respect to the 1905 partition and the 1909 award of separate electorates. That installs in some sense the kind of division of labor where you have ethnographer, historian, administrator, etc. That installed him as a kind of primary authorizing figure for a whole variety of things where he really shouldn't have been messing around. So, in that sense, I can't separate the two. As counterintuitive as that seems, and as different as those projects inherently are, they were part of the same thing for him.
I was glad that you gave importance to the H.H. Risley because many years ago, some 40 years ago, I also worked on him and found him extremely interesting. I think one should also notice that he had a deeper agenda. It was not only, the ethnology was informed by his longing for a reconstruction, a reintegration of Indian society along the lines which he envisioned. And, for instance, he tried to get Lord Curzon interested in reviving the panchayats of India because he thought this was the kind of orderly, local, indigenous organization that should be helped to come into being. Yet, to that extent, he echoed some of the feelings of later nationalists.
Right.
The nationalists, of course, as you rightly pointed out, he hated. And he found that they would be terribly upsetting. But he was also deeply read. For instance, he sent to Morley a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, pointing out to him that this tract is very important for Indian nationalists at the moment, and Morley should study this. And Morley was impressed by Risley's intellect, but suggestion came up that Risley may perhaps be promoted to a governorship in India, Morley was hesitant. He felt that Risley is too much an intellectual and doesn't have the strength that a governor would be expected to have. He finally ended up as undersecretary, a permanent undersecretary in London, but he died before he could take up.
He died before he reached London, or he died on the way? I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, he died before he could take up his office.
Yeah.
But I should like you to comment a bit more on this deeper agenda. You know, the kind of ideas which make all this fall into a pattern.
Well, of course, the commitment that Risley had to the panchayat notion was in part a traditionalist agenda, you know, that had, you know, that had a kind of intellectual pedigree that isn't necessarily a bad thing or a good thing one way or the other, but which did suit a certain disinterest in the nationalist movement. Obviously, a notion of localistic rule, but you know, within the village and so on and so forth, was not going to predicate at that point the basis on which an all-India nationalist movement would have any chance of success. I mean, the truth is, I know more about Edgar Thurston than I know about H.H. Risley, because I've worked extensively on his papers and on his life. And in many ways, Thurston is very like Risley. They had very similar kinds of interests. There was a reason why Risley picked Thurston out of the catalog of potential people who could have been in charge of the ethnographic survey for Madras. They had the same kinds of intellectual interests. Thurston had been the curator and director of the Madras Museum, a wide interest in biological and geological science, as well as in ethnology, had published on various wide variety of subjects. And also, of course, shared his enthusiasm for anthropometry. Thurston was even worse than Risley. I mean, Thurston in his memoirs said that he would have liked to stand outside the Madras Museum, and every time some unusual looking person would walk down, having seen the exhibitions, put him on exhibit himself and measure him in the process. He had to be physically taken out of the nobilis when at some point he was using the local scales in a butcher shop to weigh and measure tribal subjects who he also was picking out for his ethnographic survey. So he was more extreme. But the problem, of course, in many respects, is that these kinds of antiquarian, sometimes textual, sometimes scientific interests congealed in relationship to the state, right? So that Risley, outside of this historical context, might have been a kind of intellectual figure that one can engage with on all sorts of levels in all sorts of ways. What interests me here, and what of course I'm stressing to the exclusion of the biographical, is the way in which these kinds of interests in many ways get recruited to a colonial interest. I mean, Morley did listen to him around the question of the partition, and you and Hermann write up, you note this in your textbook on the history of India, which is the first place I actually saw the role that Risley played in that regard. So I thank you for putting me on the trail here. Or maybe you're guilty along with me in this, but of course it's that set of connections that ultimately makes problematic Risley's traditionalism and the like. A commitment to tradition in the abstract is fine, but then becomes in some sense this formation that has this the legitimacy of the colonial state, alongside it, on issues relating from ranging from widowry marriage and infant marriage to untouchability. It's a problem that no longer can be addressed through the biographical mode. So that's why I haven't done the kinds of things that are in fact interesting and that I would be happy to talk about further.
Yes, I think there's subject matter for so many more talks. I mean, there's so many themes that are being raised now. I mean, when you talk about panchayat, and you mention the village community, I mean, which in the beginning of the 19th century is a trope itself. I mean, so I think there are a lot of topics that have been raised through this talk, and I mean, for class in general. But we have another question from Srila Tambula.
I'm not quite sure how I was thinking through the question actually, but if I understood you correctly, you said that you sort of see 1857 as a watershed in some ways, after which this whole construction of caste moves from something which is to do with visionary denigration of a of an institution to becoming an object of colonial tabulation and inquiry. But the period which I'm working on is pre 1860 Tamil Nadu and Ramalinga Nayyar, who's this so-called very early social reformer. And what I find interesting is how little a caste in any sense is an issue in his writings. And in fact, it's really religion. And so, I mean, the question which I haven't thought out clearly is that, why is it that the British colonial state is taking up caste and not, religion in a major way, as the big concept. And related to that, of course, is that what is actually happening with, what exactly is, and there must be some kind of nexus going on between native formulations and the British formulation of caste.
Of course. I mean, I mean, this is a talk about the development of a particular idea that becomes appropriated by precisely the colonial state in regard to in relationship to the changing character of its own self-understanding after 1858. But at the same time, caste is there. The missionaries were complaining about it in the 1820s and 1830s, and normally in other parts of Tamil Nadu are encountering it as a very powerful social institution. And it's especially powerful in the ways in which it operates on two groups, both the two groups at the top and the bottom of, in some sense, the traditional hierarchical spectrum of the caste system. And the Brahmin is the group that the missionaries want to convert, and the other, the lower castes, are the groups that they manage to convert. And thus, it's very much there in terms of even, the British experience of this. But it's something that the colonial state, to a very large extent, stays away from as a state. Right? Now, in terms of local discourses, there are a great many, and the Mackenzie collection itself has a lot of material about caste. But what I found extraordinary, and I've surveyed the entire Mackenzie collection of Tamil materials, and I've looked at all the catalogs that have been produced from some of Mackenzie's own, to Wilson's, to Taylor's, to Mahalingam's, to a new one that's being done in Madras. The number of caste histories is very small. The number of texts, in other words, that are written specifically around the idea that caste is going to be the object of, or the subject of this textual history. What you get instead are histories of villages, histories of places, histories of temples, histories of kingly groups, of dynasties, vanshavadis. And then you get a lot of miscellaneous other kinds of texts, medical texts, chronicles of various kinds. Lots and lots of histories of various sorts, in fact, and histories that reflect the admixture of Persian influence, the circulation of texts and ideas and intellectual groups and so on and so forth across not just southern India, across the subcontinent. But you don't get a lot of past histories, and that's what set me in some sense on this trail. So why was it, in other words? The caste is there, and from a reformist interest on the one side, as well as from a missionary interest on the other, caste is very much there. But it's not the primary loci, in some sense, of textual representation. Certainly doesn't have a whole variety of genres that are attached to it. I thought you would find endless numbers of caste histories, of origin stories, of caste stories. And I didn't. Despite the fact that, of course, if you start looking in libraries from the late 19th century on, that's what you get. There's a huge proliferation. And in fact, after the census in 1901, in Bengal between 1900 and 1920, according to Srimad Sarkar, you get a huge proliferation of caste histories, right? Because it becomes the way in which you address the classification of the census is by writing a history which claims a different kind of place in the social spectrum. These are not reformist texts, these are associational texts. But not for the earlier period. And so that's in some sense what I'm addressing. It's not the fact that caste was there, or that from the perspective either of a reformist or a missionary, caste would in some sense be preeminent. But from the point of view of a textual history, and this goes back to your question, it's other sites for the telling of history that are much more important. So I don't know if that really addresses your question, but that's what I'm pointing to. So it's a partial history, but it's a history nevertheless that reflects a particular cut that is consistent across this period of time.
Thank you. We are really getting into very different waters here. Also touching on topics that for which we have specialists here. I think the topic of missionaries, you mentioned it a number of times, and I think there needs to be some differentiated approach to the different kinds of orientation that missionaries at different stages have. And I think there's a question from one of our missionary specialists, you know, Prince Sweetman, perhaps on this topic, so I won't say any more. Will.
Actually, you partly answered this in answer to the previous question, but I wanted to just ask you something more about the connection between missionary writing in the past and missionary critique of Sati and Thuggy. Because it seems to me you moved a little bit too quickly from one to the other. You mentioned the missionary scapegoat in the past, and then they used the scandals of Sati and Thuggy.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that the missionary writing in the past is actually not quite so uncomplicatedly critical or outraged as it is on Sati and Thuggy. I can see with Thuggy that the criminal past is perhaps a limited past. But I wonder if you could say how you see the relationship between Sati as a scandal and was it being strategically used by missionaries as a way of combating caste? If they saw caste as the main problem,
I wasn't suggesting that there was a substantive connection between sati as a kind of social fact or emblematization of caste and the subsequent interest that missionaries had in caste per se. I was suggesting the strategic use of sati, and I'm suggesting this on the. Can you hear me? All right. And I was suggesting this in part on the basis of a survey of the way in which the writings of William Ward are excerpted in and reproduced in the missionary register. It's quite specific that when, and actually I get this not from my own work, I get this from Lethemoni's book, but if you look at between page 140 and 160, you'll see that she has gone through the writings of William Ward between, say, 1811. Is that when he writes his first, publishes his first version? To 1821. And two things, she observes two things. One is that Ward's writings actually change in a decade and become more and more tendentious, more judgmental, more, in some sense, appropriated by a language of scandal as you go on through the decade. But secondly, that the material that gets excerpted from Ward in the missionary register is specifically around issues of scandal, and Sati is the most successful, convenient, and dramatic scandal. Human sacrifice actually does figure there as well on a fairly regular basis. So I was suggesting not a substantive leap, but a kind of strategic one. Once missionaries start writing, and now I'm referring to the letters in the archives that I've looked at, mostly Protestant missionaries, mostly from Southern Talmud, which is what I worked on. They don't write about Sati at all, of course. But no, Sati is, I mean, among the communities they're writing about, Sati is not, I mean, it happened. I mean, there are reports, which reports from the Jesuit letters of the 17th century, Sati is not every now and then. There are examples even in the history of the Pudukote family that there was Sati. But it's not something that the missionaries write about. They're obviously at that point writing about caste. And that's what I meant. Now, inasmuch as you're suggesting that the missionaries had a more complicated relationship to caste, I'm sure that's true, but that was just the move that I was making. Yeah.
thank you. I think there's another question from Professor Funke. I'm right.
Yes.
Yes.
I wonder whether it's too unpolite to ask or to go a bit towards away from the 19th century to the present situation in India. I mean, we are talking all the time, you have been talking about the period when the British had created a ethnographic state, but it was a period when Priestley and others contributed to that, and the point is a little bit, at that time we had these caste associations, caste mattered a lot, but isn't it that only caste has become a real political fact now, during the last, let's say, two decades? I mean, has caste ever mattered politically so much after the colonial period? I mean, organizing vote banks according to creating political power on the basis of caste has never been as strong as now, to my estimation. It's maybe right or wrong. My question is now, does this present development of castification of politics, maybe even of the state on the local basis or the the states, not the central government, Lok Sabha, whether this has to do something with the 19th century, is that a heritage of colonial period, or is that purely Indian?
You know, this is it's a very good question, and it's a very hard one to address, certainly in brevity. You're quite right that, you know, caste politics, I mean, if you look at Christoph Jaffrelot's last book, or at least one of his last books, India's Silent Revolution, he shows across the board, not just in South India, but across the North, of course, going back to the 80s in particular, so, you know, telling your story with a lot of tables to provide evidence of the rise of caste politics, its importance at every level, and its growing availability for a variety of insurgent movements to capture forms of political power that that the lower castes had never been able to have before. And in many ways, it's the most optimistic history of the last two decades of Indian politics that one can think of, because of course it is vindicated in, at least in part and at least until now, by the results of the last election. So in that sense, you know, it's obviously a very important counterweight to the growing importance that's been attached to religious identity in the last decade in particular. Now, when talking about the colonial uses of caste, I'm not suggesting that caste is a bad thing for politics at all. On the contrary, and I say this at the end of Caste in Mind, I was myself very concerned not to, in some sense, allow the kind of critical history that I was writing to become easily available. You can't prevent it from becoming available, but easily available to the forces that were arguing that caste was a bad thing. It was divisive, it was anti-national, and therefore it should be discounted as a genuine basis for social mobilization, for political redress, for economic redistribution, and so on and so forth. In the wake of the whole, and I talk about this in, you know, in chapter 13, in the wake of the whole controversy over Mundell, there were all of a sudden a bunch of very prominent intellectuals who were suggesting for the first time that colonialism had played a nasty role in constructing caste. And I refer, for example, to André Bété. In 1986, I gave a paper at the London School of Economics where André was there. And I talked about the material from the Hollow Crown, and I talked about my sense that caste had become much more important in the late 19th century, but I hadn't gotten there yet. So I sort of laid out, I finished the book, and I was laying out the next project, and he said caste had nothing to do, and colonialism played no role in this at all. Colonialism had no effect on caste. In 1992, in an op-ed piece in The Hindu, he writes about the colonial construction of caste as a bad thing, and use that to justify an argument against Mundell. Well, not only did it seem disingenuous to change his mind in that way, but it was obviously a way of making me very uncomfortable, among others, for making an argument that could obviously be used in some ways in a retrogressive political context. I'm not suggesting that one have an opinion one way or the other about Mundell, which is right and wrong. I am suggesting that the uses and appropriations of certain kinds of historical accounts come back to haunt you whenever you think you're on the right side or whatever. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but to talk about the last two decades, of course this is Indian politics at work. But of course, and as an historian you will agree, the mobilization of groups on the basis of caste is a history that requires resort, among other things, to the history of the census, the history of colonial ethnology, and the kinds of things that I've been writing about here. We're talking about here.
So quite ironical, paradoxical that caste as a category ceases to be used in the census of 1931. And just as nationalism, the national movement is also trying to downplay the caste act. How would you explain this? I mean, the conjunction of these.
Well, the commissioner of the 1931 census was J.F. Hutton. And Hutton hated Risley. He said, if you read some of his correspondence, he said, Risley started all the trouble that we're dealing with here, which is the politicization of caste. I mean, basically he blamed the politicization of caste on Risley. And said that, and he's the one who advocated that caste, at least he's one of the people. I don't know if you've worked on this too, but in my reading of this, he's one of the people who played a big role in getting the practice to stop. So I think there was a recognition, more generally, that the genie had come out of the bottle, and that something that had been designed for a kind of easy access to order and name the enumerative materials that were being accumulated by the census had unleashed certainly a set of unintended consequences. And the petitions that came to each census commissioner as they were conducting preparations for the census grew in each decade, and that's what Hutton was responding to, and made them aware that, in some sense, the more you talk about social precedence, the more you're going to create unease and disaffection.
So the conjunction with the nationalist downplaying.
Well, the conjunction with that is, in that sense, it's complicated, of course, because on the one hand, there were caste movements that were certainly in the 1920s much less critical of British colonial rule than either the mainstream nationalist movements or some of the communist movements or movements that disavowed caste across the board. And so one could see a deliberate strategy of dividing rule trying to exercise itself. I think it's more complicated than that. I think that the net effect of the petitions that seem to suggest that caste would, as well as other kinds of things, become a kind of source of political disaffection was reason enough to discontinue the practice without having to make a more elaborate and consistent argument about divida et impera. But
thank you.
My question is, presuming you mentioned earlier, I would want to know about the transition from the pre-colonial period to the colonial period. For in 1670, when Lord North Nancy committed suicide and left to us the compact statistics of Marwar, who was the Munshi of the Marwar Kingdom, he at the same time left to us lists and long lists of castes, mainly in connection with catastral papers. And these, in a way, mirror the system of the Ayinia Kapoli, with the exception that it added the notion of castes, which was not there in the Ayin. So I was under the impression that these were just givens in the situation of the Rajputs and the relation of that force. But recently, Simon and Ziegler argue that this is also the kind of self-assertion of Rajputs, Jats, and other castes in the system of the Mughal state, in the contest for their position, respective positions in the bureaucratic empire, so that it is already very ideological. And I would want to know if the colonial specialists in statistics ever took interest in these things and took this perhaps as an example too, or is there just the break between two systems?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for a difficult question, to be sure. I don't know if I can really answer the question, but I can certainly say that a recent paper by Norbert Peabody, which came out in Comparative Studies in Society and History last year, really invoked a slightly different view of this and suggested that caste was used in certain censuses in the pre-colonial period in Oliver, I think, in his case. Was it not Oliver where he works? Yeah. And I think Sumit Guha has also been looking at some of these questions of late as well. You know, when you make an argument like this, you open yourself up for questions that you can't actually deal with at all. But my sense is that the consolidation of a certain 17th century, early 18th century Rajput claim for Kshatriya status is part of this move to insert a kind of Brahmanic discourse on top of the Aini Akbar kinds of classificational rubrics that are fairly common. What led me to initially make the kinds of claims that I did was having looked at these kinds of records for a number of states in the South in the 17th and 18th centuries, and not finding it there in the same kind of way, only to find, of course, that there are other kinds of instances of this that complicate the story. The other thing that, or one of the other things that would complicate the story of the transition, would be the importance in the 17th century of a whole variety of new commentaries on the Manushmiti by specialists on the Dhamma Sutras, many of them from Benares, many of them recruited to write about this in connection with the coronation of Shivaji, which generated a huge explosion of writing about whether this was possible, whether if possible it worked, what were the basis of the claims, was the ritual conducted properly, and so on and so forth. Around this place in the Kshatriya. So I suspect that if one were to sort of start thicken this account, one would find a very interesting set of developments both in Western and Northwest India that anticipate some of the kinds of things that happened under a later colonial regime. But then, the break in some sense comes when you look at what develops under the Peshwa regime and what continues to be the case among most of the Rajput states where the sort of preoccupation again with whether one can be Kshatriya either moves into a different place or stays more or less at the same level. I think it's certainly the case from talking to people who have worked in the Peshwa Daftar that a lot of the things that I talk about here are going on in Pune in the late 17th, early 18th centuries as well too. So of course there's a much bumpier story to tell. But I think there are distinctions, nevertheless. And they have to do in part with some of the distinctions that Gurung Singh calls our attention to, which is that the claims about caste that are being made by the British under the authority of the colonial state do take on a very different kind of meaning. They're not about claims that the British are making for themselves. Right? And so it sets in motion a different kind of logic. Not a logic that's altogether new, to be sure. Not a logic that has no anticipations in the pre-colonial record, but a logic that nevertheless has to be understood, I think, within the specific conjury of imperatives, initiatives, and entailments that are part of the colonial projects in the late 19th and early 20th century, what I call the time of the ethnographic state. So that's how I would respond, in some sense, by continuing the conversation, but drawing a line at that one point in that one way.
Thank you. I think we have time for just one last question from Vasundhara Dalia, because we will have time for more discussions tomorrow.
In conclusion, I'd like to go back to your beginning and your end, and that is, you ended with Nestle. You showed us that there were obvious shifts in this response. Yet you also seem to be suggesting that there were some continuities. It would be very interesting to hear what these were or how you see these. You seem to be suggesting that God is using us as a universal. Was the amount of respect, the respect that he has paid to this decentralization. You seem to be suggesting that Christians is also doing the same. What then are the continuities? He seems to be paying a certain respect to the Indian way of doing things, or as he sees this Indian way.
Risley? Or Burke? Yeah, I don't really see that as much with Risley, despite his the complexity of his biographical interest. He's very much invested in the management of racial and social difference for the purposes of the colonial state, which I think marks him out quite distinctly from Burke. The continuity that I was calling attention to was not in relationship to what to Burke's universalization of caste as a kind of principle. In fact, I was arguing the opposite. I was suggesting that what Burke was doing was to invoke a number of universal categories, imperatives, natural laws, right, about despotism, about power, about arbitrary power. No one, as he says in his famous quote, Hastings could not exercise arbitrary power, for arbitrary power would not be his. He could only get that from, in some sense, from God or from some kind of natural principle. What Burke says in the quote is this: if we must govern such a country, we must govern them upon their own principles and maxims and not upon ours, that we must not think to force them to our narrow ideas, but extend ours to take in theirs. And I read that, you know, through his other writings to show that there's in fact an intransitivity in the way in which he constructs ours and theirs. Right? The ours can be particular and universal. And that's what the ancient constitution is. The ancient constitution is an accommodation of tradition, custom, practice with the universal. Because in fact, the universal is what checks what can be done, what cannot be done. It is the measure for the legitimate. But the ancient constitution is also invoked by him as the ground on which the we can take the particular of the now into account and fold it into a universal understanding that can't work the other way around. There's no suggestion that the ancient constitution of India could have the same universal status. So the hierarchicalization of the we and the they works in precisely that relationship between the particular and the universal. For Risley, that's the same, but it's not interesting, right? Because that's not his interest, and that's not what, you know, he writes about it, and that's not what we remember him for. And I could say more about that, but that's the continuity I was calling attention to. And that's an imperial idea. That's the argument.
could be another ending story. It could go on as long as Warren Hastings' impeachment, but I think you want to have some fun as well. We booked a table in the Indian Palace, which is just round the corner from here, in Kettengasse, which is that way here. In Kettengasse, so we have 500 people there. I think some of them are welcome, or would like to come. And of course, our discussion will continue tomorrow in the workshop, which is at the Southern Asian Institute. Starts at 9:15 and goes on until 4:30. Thereabouts. So thank you very much for participating in this new experiment. I mean, using a microphone in this august hall, and there will be opportunities to speak to Professor Dirks not only tomorrow but also on Saturday. He's leaving only on Sunday, so if anybody would like to join us, both on the NECA or going to the classroom, very welcome. But thank you very much for being here today, and everything has been taped. So you may be able to hear it on our website. Thank you for that.